pass on a bit of commission to some other firm of brokers, so that you only had one firm of brokers in the market. Another reason for doing that is that two different firms of brokers might have come on to you with investment advice along a certain line, and you don't want to put them both into the market, but you want to reward them both. And sometimes you would have a particularly tricky order, and you would want a particularly good dealing partner to... I mean, there was a chap who we used a lot like that, Jerry Church, who was the dealing partner of Lang & Cruickshank, who, yeah, was very good at dealing with quite tricky things. And Greece and Grant was a particular dealing partner there who we, you know, would get to do the most difficult things. And, they'd often split the commission.
Mm. Now, you said that sending different brokers in with virtually the same order was something you didn't do. Do you think other institutions had different attitudes to this? I mean, how would you characterise...
Oh, I think some did, just because they didn't understand the market. Mm. And they didn't understand that, on the whole, if you're at Christie's buying a picture, it's desirable not to have five people in to bid against yourself. Mm. Exactly the same. Mm. Exactly the same as buying a car in some market in Little Tittlecombe. Mm.
Did you think institutions ever tried to pit themselves against the stock exchange in the sense of manipulate the system to try and get the best possible deal themselves?
I think they did. And I don't think that was time very well spent. And in fact, not very desirable to pitch yourself against your own advisors, actually.
Again, would you say it was common or uncommon? Was it characteristics of, say, the merchant banks, or...?
It was a characteristic of those investment institutions who were too clever for their own good.
Did you ever have jobbers coming back to institutions and complaining directly about, for example, the amount of put-throughs that are being done or the things that...
We never had that, and if we had, the jobbers would have been told to... if they wanted to talk to us, they must talk to us through brokers.
Mm.
I mean, there was a perfectly clear... The advantage of the system was that there was a perfectly clear distinction. The stockbrokers were our agents and paid for by us, and the jobbers were there, and their sole purpose was to make money for themselves, for their companies or their partnerships. What they got up to was no concern of mine. If I thought the stockbroker had dealt badly, or any of my managers thought that, he'd get a right proper bollocking.
Did price agreements ever come into your experience as a fund manager, in the sense of the jobbers getting together and deciding that they were going to deal on a particular spread?
Oh yes, I think that probably went on. I think the important bit of price regulation that used to happen was that if a company was going to make a rights issue or going to have a bid or some announcement, it was often quite important the market should remain stable in the run-up to that. And I think really good stockbroking firms would just talk to the jobbers and say, come on, we want level markets for a couple of hours to deal with this. And that was a useful rolling of the pitch, actually. And although it might occasionally act to somebody's disadvantage, the next time it was done might equally act to their advantage. And that was the great thing about that period in the city, that if you actually explained something that was reasonable, there were ways to sort things out. But if you're looking at some ridiculous bit of machinery with just sort of figures on it, as you do now, all these sort of things that people have on their desks, you actually can't do that sort of thing.
Mm. Now, we've already referred to the issue of commissions and how that was one of the things that was pushing at the door of single capacity. Another pressure was the internationalization of stock trading. Did you find that you were going outside the stock exchange to deal in international stocks? Was that...
No, because our house rule really was that we tried never to deal with anybody direct except through a stockbroker. Partly we're trustees. I mean, I always took the attitude that we were trustees for our unit holders, and everything must be by us at arm's length too. And I think the more that went through the market, the better.
So if you'd wanted a Canadian stock or an American stock or a gold stock, you wouldn't have gone to, say, an American merchant bank in London who you knew might be making a market in those stocks?
Well, we might, we'd go to wherever was the right place to deal. I'm not very good on overseas markets, but we would have gone wherever it was possible to deal without double commissions. That was one of the problems there was on. But it's no good asking me about that. I don't know enough about it. There is one other thing before I forget, the advantage of the old system. One of the things that used to happen is that one would make a mistake in dealing. One would sell 200,000 of a share, and in fact you'd only 20,000 for some extraordinary reason, and naught had got in. Or you sold A shares instead of ordinary shares, and you'd made a mistake. Only once in 25 years can I remember the old system being incapable of sorting out the shambles. And brokers made mistakes, we made mistakes, and jobbers made mistakes, but it was a marvelous system for quite peaceably sorting out the problems, which could sometimes be really quite expensive. And you'd come to reasonable agreements.
Now, did that change after Big Bang?
Well, I think so, because you're dealing with them impersonal things. You're dealing with machines and much more difficult.
Did you feel during the 70s or the early 80s that there was much of a market going on in domestic securities outside of the stock exchange? Because this is something that people occasionally refer to and say was going on, but most people are pretty vague when it comes to
details. Yes, I'm totally vague.
Mm.
Totally vague. I don't know. I mean, I always took the attitude that if you've got stock markets, the more that goes through them, the better for everybody concerned.
Would it ever have been attractive for one institution to deal direct with another?
Occasionally it was tried. Mm. Golly, what was that thing called? Ariel. Ariel, have people talked to you about Ariel? M&G wouldn't join Ariel as a matter of principle. Mm. Because I expect the reason was that, it was all a weakening of the stock exchange.
Mm.
Yeah.
Who are the prime movers behind that?
Well, they were merchant banks. Mm. I mean, the merchant banks always saw themselves as potential rivals to the stock exchange. Mm. And they thought the stock exchange made too much money and they wanted to get their hands in the till, to put it quite crudely. Mm. And I mean, they were the force behind Big Bang and the internationalization point. But I've never thought that was a really very good point, because our single capacity we could have gone on with, and despite the, I mean, just because the Americans didn't understand it, there was no reason to change the system. Mm. And I think junk bonds and everything like that would have been much more difficult with a single capacity.
To what extent were investors discussing the changing shape of the stock market during the 70s and 80s?
Well, I think not much in the 70s, but in the 80s, that a great deal, because most of the institutions thought they'd get lower dealing charges, and therefore it was in their interests, and better markets. I always took the view that the people who'd suffer, that might be true, but the people who'd suffer would be the small man. And the old commission system, the large clients did subsidize the small ones, and I thought that was very healthy for markets. There were also quite good sort of theological reasoning behind it.
What caused M&G and you personally to take such a strong line in 1984, 1985, over the changes that the Stock Exchange Council were planning for the stock market?
My bloody-mindedness, I suspect. I mean, I've been involved in politics and everything, and I'm always damn sure that when everybody's going one way, you can be sure that it's right to go the way the minority thinks. Mm. And no, I just thought it was all sort of fashionable fad. Mm. And with quite a bit of greed and envy. I mean, there's a lot of envy of what stockbrokers earned. Huge envy. And some of them didn't deserve it, but a lot of them did.
Could you explain briefly what the arguments were that you what criticisms you made of the proposed changes?
Oh, well, that with single capacity there weren't conflicts of interest, and with dual capacity there'd be everlasting conflicts of interest. Yeah. And I mean, I could see the advantages of lower commission charges for big people, but I thought that it would get more and more difficult for small investors to buy and sell shares, and that's become true. And I thought there'd be fewer firms of brokers, and I thought the big American boys and the merchant banks would all try and cash in on the whole outfit, as indeed they did. Fortunately, they mostly lost money as a result. No, I thought it was sort of change for change's sake. There was the Bank of England saying we must be leaders in world markets. I've always found, actually, that the business one doesn't do is sometimes a very good thing not to have done it. You know, you can overtrade. There was the whole emphasis was on everybody overtrading, taking on more and more business and all that sort of thing. And I think, and all these partnerships of fairly small firms of brokers or middling-sized firms of brokers, they were very personal. And investment's about personal relationships. Good investment. But this is all old-fashioned talk. I mean, there's not a semblance of this now. Well, not much. But there will be a revival in about 10 years' time, and it'll all go into reverse.
Did you feel quite strongly that pressure was being put on the Stock Exchange Council by the bank or by the government?
Yeah, by both. Mm. And the trouble is, Borrie didn't really understand it. I mean, he's competition mad. I mean, he's paid to be competition mad, and in fact, I believe that competition is really good up to a certain point. Purely subjective. I'm not an economist, but don't understand these things. Don't try to, but there's just a bit when you push theory beyond a certain point. And I think that there was nothing that, not much anyway, that couldn't have been dealt with by a change in the commission rules and that. No, I regret the passing of single capacity. I still do.
Did you have any feeling at the time that it might have been possible for the Stock Exchange Council to rethink and not to abolish single capacity in the way they did? Because, I mean, in actual fact, the agreement with Cecil Parkinson didn't necessarily involve the abolition of single capacity. That was a subsequent step.
Yeah, they could have, but I think the pressures on them were so acute. Yeah, I was on that Bank of England, the Governor's Committee, on advising on the future of the city. And the steam engine had got up such a pressure of steam that nobody could stand against the desire to change. I mean, talk about gathering swine. They were all galloping for all they were worth.
What was the reaction in the city and among your business associates to the remarks that you were making and the high profile that you were adopting? Although I can see how the press would be interested in taking someone up who...
Oh, they, a lot of people said it was right, but I was pretty crudely pissing in the wind. And it was just old, you know, old Hobbies on his war horse. Well, I wasn't actually. I was being fairly well thought out. I don't often appear on television because I hate the thing. But I think it was Thames TV did a program on Big Bang. And I was amazed by the reaction to that, the amount of letters I got, and of support. No letters of abuse. Quite a lot of ashamed people that they weren't standing up and being counted. A lot of ashamed people, yes.
What do you think made the difference between those who were prepared to support in the background and someone who was prepared to make a public?
Well, I was lucky. I mean, the date of my retirement coincided with Big Bang, a fine piece of timing established by God 60 years earlier. Nothing to lose, and actually it's always been my way to say exactly what I think. This is one of the sort of rarities that, on the whole, you know, it's considered rather odd, people saying what they think.
What was the reaction among the institutions, the other main investing institutions, to the 1983 decision? I mean, did they simply see a bonanza for them and the slashing of commissions?
Yeah, they saw it all in those terms. They terribly bad at looking at the big picture. Terribly bad at looking at the big picture. And very short-sighted, I think. And I did try very hard to, get a compromise, but...
Now, one of the points that you were often reported as making at the time was the possibility of corruption and cheating taking place under the new system. Did you feel that there may have equally been the possibility for cheating and corruption under the old system, in the sense of brokers who became too close to jobbers, fund managers who possibly...
Strange enough, I don't remember this as a line I took. I do think the danger of corruption and cheating, if those are the right words, lay in the fact that there were such substantial conflicts of interest under the new. We never knew who the hell anybody was working for. I mean, we now have more agency brokers again than there were, say, a year ago, because they want to just provide a service for their clients. I think corruption and cheating comes when things get too big. The advantages of partnerships of stockbrokers were that they were partnerships, and their financial controls may have been incompetent, but if they were good firms, they were simply not going to have any nonsense. The new system has had to set up this huge pyramid of compliance officers and goodness knows what. I mean, huge edifices and millions of pounds it's costing. You didn't actually have to have compliance officers before. It was just assumed that everybody was honest. And that's actually the only way to run your life.
Was there ever any temptations for someone in a investing institution, not necessarily the manager, fund manager, but someone who may have known whether there was a big order in the offing, of using that information in what we'd now call insider trading? Has that ever been a problem?
It was always a danger, but I mean, anybody who did it just got their head chopped off. So that was concerned. I mean, there were very strict rules. Nobody could ever, I mean, all my I had no investments. They were all in M&G Unit Trust, so there could never be any conflict there. Anybody else who dealt in the office, well, all had to be reported every day, long before all this became a requirement. And in fact, there'll always be fiddle somewhere or other, and you can't legislate against it. I mean, there'll always be sin. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think there are more opportunities. I don't know. Now that there are compliance officers and everybody's phone calls are tapped and all this sort of thing recorded. I mean, that's horrible. Mm. I mean, I don't think people realize what an appalling thing that is in the city. They've just taken it as that everybody's phone calls are tapped and recorded and conversations, everything. I think that's absolutely terrible. That you should set up a system where that's necessary.
In retrospect, do you feel many of the criticisms you made in 84, 85 have been justified in subsequent experience?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I've kept quiet for the last 3 years, but I do actually think I think the really fundamental thing is that the city used to be a happy place and fun working in. Oh, it's so serious now, and people's calls recorded and not allowed to give advice to people. I mean, the conception that, that everybody always gave dishonest advice and therefore nobody can give advice unless they're registered with God knows who, is frightful, I think. Terrible. Terrible. And,
well, let me quote back at you something again that you've probably forgotten.
No, I haven't talked, yes, I have. I haven't talked to anybody on these lines for years. Yeah, what have you got there?
Well, in one of the articles in the Times in 1984, they you're referring to the possibility of, well, the increased possibilities for corruption. When those brought up in the old school are succeeded by a new generation. Now, what you've probably mentioned already some of the qualities of people in what you'd call the old school. How would you contrast city people and stock exchange people in the earlier part of your working life with the present day?
Well, I think in a nutshell, there was this book that issued the other day called Creative Tensions, which was the first time I put pen to paper for 3 years. And I said that I thought the big change of the last 3 years, particularly amongst the young people, I'm not really blaming them. And they're now working for themselves. Their principal objective is to make money for themselves. Not too fussy about how they do it, whereas years ago the principal objective was to make money for your client, and if you were good at doing that, you would actually make money for yourself. It was the other way around. This is a wild generalization, but in fact that is the essence of the thing, and I think all these young men wheeler dealing, terrifying, and I think all this business of the huge turnover of leading shares, and people jobbing in and out and jumping in and out, and is not desirable at all, because it hides the whole subject of, if you've got own shares, they're not commodities and they're not pork bellies. They are, I mean, you've got companies and they have a life of their own. There's management, owners, workforce, consumers, suppliers, etc. But if you just treat stocks and shares as if they were any old lump of gold or lump of platinum or something, or palm oil, quite different considerations apply to that. I think I said a no.
But you've said finally there were any weaknesses in the old single capacity system.
Oh yes, the weaknesses were that the charging system was wrong. And the stock exchange was puerile on letting new people come in, keeping women out, for instance. I mean, childish things like that. Absolutely infantile. And no wonder people wanted to destroy it, but that was the moment that you had to keep a sense of proportion and say, well, that's just frivolous. Oh, yeah, they were terribly stupid like that.
Do you think that was one of the problems, that the stock exchange was run as a club rather than as a...
Yes. Oh, and I hope to hell my own club's not as badly run as that was. Mm. I mean, they were badly run. Mm. Oh, yeah. But then you don't throw the bathwater out with the bath, or the bath out with the bathwater, whichever way around that phrase should be, which is what happened. Because they were so stick in the mud over that sort of thing. Very sad.
Well, I think we can finish on that note. Thank you very much.